Okay, so let's, I guess, do we agree it's 1 o'clock, or who here thinks we're still too early? Who here says 1 o'clock? Who here says too early? Okay, so presumably it's 1 o'clock. Okay, the way I like to do this is, first of all, again, as you notice, the daily problems things, I have the folders up here. Before I start my lecture, all the problems have to be in. I will magically close these things when I get ready to start the lecture, okay? I have them right now to try to simplify processing of them. I have them grouped by 4 bunches of letters of the alphabet. Put it in there by last name. If you say, I don't know which of my names is first name or last name, just use the same one each time. We're using this basically as a hash function. For those of you who will learn about these things in class a little later, we want to hash them into buckets so that the same thing appears in the same bucket every time. Any questions? Okay, any other logistical questions, course detail questions that came up, okay, that we need to resolve? Okay, there are some people who have been, again, the Piazza thing has been set up. Some people are reacting to that, and that, I guess, is good. Any questions about how you use Piazza? I think people can solicit program partners, homework partners and things like that on there, and other things. Any questions about that or any questions that arise there? My goal is to have as little to do with the Piazza as possible, but if there becomes a problem that I should be dealing with, let me know. Any questions? Okay. As far as the daily problems, again, the daily problems are to be done individually is the point. So some people want to know if you could do them in pairs. That's not the idea here. Any other logistical questions about the course before we get going? Yes?
Can you form larger groups than 2?
Can you form larger groups than 2? I think that the value of a group diminishes rapidly once the size hits 2. So the answer is I frown on groups of size larger than 2. Do I absolutely forbid them? I'm frowning on them, and so try not to do it. If there is some unbelievably great reason why you have to do it, then we can discuss it. But I don't know too many absolutely great reasons. Okay, I think it's better to do it with 2. Yes. Okay, are we going to use any specific programming languages? The answer is there will be little programming pieces in a couple of assignments, and one assignment that really is a program, the homework 4, where we're going to be doing backtracking. You will be able to use whatever language you want, okay, on that one. So there's no language choice. Use whatever language you feel best about, okay? The great thing about algorithms is it is a language-independent subject, okay? So it doesn't really matter about that. Any other questions about logistics? Yes? Are partners mandatory on the homeworks? Partners are very strongly recommended on the homeworks, okay? Does that mean that they're absolutely mandatory? The answer is no. Do I think it is better to have a partner? I think the answer is yes, okay? I believe that pretty strongly because, again, these should be interaction things. But if, you know, for some reason you're absolutely allergic to a partner or something like that, I'm not going to make you have a partner. Okay? But I do think that it's a good thing to do in general. Okay? Any questions? Any other? So I do recommend it. The vast majority of you people should be with partners. Okay? Any questions? Okay. And I think next class I will pass out distribute the first assignment. So that's when you really need to know about having partners. Any other questions? Okay. Yes. Everything is on the website. The course, everything that I intend to distribute is on the course website. The only thing that of interest that I can think of that is not on the course website seems to be the videos from the class. That seems to be on on Blackboard. I have verified that they have the video seems to work, although it does not seem to capture a separate panel for my lecture notes. That's what I was discussing with the previous instructor. So. But we'll do the best that we can. If you want to look at my lecture notes while you are watching me on television, okay, give the lecture, the right thing to note is that the lecture notes are posted on the website. Does everybody see that? If you go to the home page of the website, they'll be in there. It says the new lecture notes are in here, and that's where they will be. So that's how you can follow along with them. Any questions? Okay, anything else? Okay, so that is the end of the preliminary thing. So now I will seal up the daily problems and make sure that nobody submits anything else. Okay? That's kind of important. Okay, boom. And in general, I'll try to have a shorter preliminary time beforehand. So when you get here on time, turn it in. Any questions? Okay, the next order of business is the daily problem of today, which should have been this one. Does everybody agree it's this problem on the backtrack, on the knapsack problem? So what does it say? Let's go through it and try to understand what it's saying. It says that the knapsack problem is the following. You're given a set of integers, okay, and a target number. And you want to find a subset of integers, of these numbers, that adds up exactly to the target. And the claim is that 1, 2, 5, 9, 10, there is a subset that adds up to 22. What's a subset that adds up to 22? Can anyone give me a subset that adds up to 22? 1, 2, 9, and 10 will do it, but the claim is that no one can find one that adds up to 23. Does everybody see that? So the problem is I give you a target, and I give you a set of numbers. Is there a subset that adds up to it? Okay? First question, before I even get into this, why would anyone care about this problem? One thing that's a useful exercise in here, you know, is not that I'm giving algorithm problems in general that are completely toy problems, okay? Usually the problems here, I mean, part of it is as an exercise for you to train your algorithm thinking. But also recognize that a lot of these problems arise for a reason, that they are capturing the flavor of a class of applications. So what was it? There was you. This is like related to packing, okay? Like you want to try to figure out what's the maximum amount of stuff you can get into a particular unit, right? This is like the backpack, a backpack problem. You have a backpack. You are a thief going into a jewelry store. You have a backpack with a capacity of 22 units. There are jewelry items of particular sizes, okay, sitting on, you know, out for you to grab. You want to grab, can you fill the knapsack with jewelry? A broken piece of jewelry isn't worth anything, right? So you want to go and figure out, what is the biggest number, weight of whole items I can put in to put in my max knapsack? Does everybody see that? And that's the flavor of a large number of packing problems and things like that. Any questions about that? Okay. It's like when you have a dollar. I have a dollar to spend at the candy store. Okay, these candy items cost different amounts. What's the maximum amount of candy I can walk out with? You are solving a knapsack problem. Does everybody see that? Okay. So let's think of now the second part of it is find counterexamples to each of the following algorithms. I'm going to say by a counterexample, it means find an S and a T, a subset and a target, such that the subset selected using the algorithm does not leave the knapsack completely full, even if a solution exists. Your algorithm is clearly wrong if, given an example, it doesn't find a solution when there is one. Okay? And we want you to give counterexamples to the following algorithms. Any questions? Okay, so let's look at, it's funny, his picture was kind of pretty. I'll save his picture for as long as I can. Okay, so what is the first algorithm we're talking about is a algorithm where you process the elements in S from left to right order, okay, and stick it in the knapsack if it fits. So in order to do this, don't touch it. Do not touch it. Step away from the problems. Step away from the problems. Step away. No. Okay? That's not how we're going to do it in here. Okay, you have to come in at the beginning of class. If not, if you're late a little day, it's not a big deal. Okay? But I don't want people coming in here and dealing with it then. Any questions? Okay? So for this problem, the first fit order. Insert them from left to right. Can someone give me an S and a T such that that algorithm will do the wrong thing? Okay, let's say you. One, two, three, and T is 5. And your claim is, let's see it. If we execute the algorithm, it's going to say, yeah, I want to stuff that in my knapsack. Yeah, I want to stuff that in my knapsack. Now I've got 3 things in there. This is too full, I can't do it. But in fact, if I had been cleverer about it, I could have gotten away and filled the knapsack. Does everybody see this is a counterexample? Right? And it's kind of a nice counterexample. Okay? The items are sorted. Okay? There's a small number of items here. Right? I don't know if you could really break this in a neat way. I guess you could break it with 2 items, right? If you would want it to do something clumsy like this, then this would be probably an even smaller example. Does everybody see that? But this is one I can understand and explain. That heuristic clearly doesn't work. Okay? Any questions? Let's look at the second one. The second one says put the elements in the knapsack from smallest to largest, which is something they call the best fit heuristic. Can anybody find a counterexample to this one? Okay? Yes? Okay, in fact, this example does the exact same thing, both of them, right? Because the items are already in sorted order. It doesn't pay for you to do it from, you know, this example breaks it in exactly the same way as before. Does everybody see that? Okay, good. The third version of it is, put the elements in the knapsack from largest to smallest. Okay? Now, in this case, this will do perfectly well, right? If we put this one in from largest to smallest, 3, 5, ding, 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 we got it, right? Now, is there a counterexample to the largest ones? Okay, from largest to smallest. Okay, any questions? Yes? Oh, an answer. What's an answer? 1, 2, 4, and 5 being the target. Okay, is that what you're suggesting? Well, this one I don't think breaks it. If I'm going from largest to smallest, what am I going to do? I'm going to insert 4. 2 doesn't fit, but I have hopes that I can do it later on. I'm not going to immediately die just because it didn't fit in. I'm going to keep looking, and this one, in fact, does do it. So that's not a counterexample to what I think I see. Yes? 4, 3, 3 with a goal of 6. So we want to do 4. Okay, let's keep them sorted. 4, 3, 3 with a goal of 6. Okay, and now here you're again stuck again. You start out by grabbing 4, and now you can't pick up either of these. Okay, but that's it. Okay, anyone have a simpler example? This isn't so bad. Okay, you might say it's a little not unclean. It's perfectly fine, but you know, maybe a little repetitions. Yeah. 4, 3, 2, and 5. This one would do. Okay, and again, this one's still a good example. There's nothing, no reason to feel bad about it. But one thing that is true, it is good sometimes and a good practice to try to find the simplest one that you can, because that sort of shows you, you know, that kind of shows you what, you know, that there isn't. Sometimes you can change the problem a little bit to come up with a faster algorithm. Suppose, let's say that this heuristic worked except when there were, when they were all unique items. Okay? This wouldn't suffice to prove that. This proves something stronger, that the heuristic doesn't work even if the items are not unique. So just as a style thing, in general, you want as simple and as powerful a counterexample as you can. But the main thing is you want one that disproves the algorithm. Okay? Anything else is just for extra style. Yes? One, two, four, five. The reason is as I interpret this heuristic, what the heuristic is going to do is I'm going to One by one, consider the item. Stick it in the item if it in the knapsack if it has room. If it doesn't have any room, set it aside. And the point being that I would try stick this one in. I've now got room for one more item. The next biggest item is of size 2. I can't put that in.
Wait, you don't know you can't put it in yet.
Well, I can try to put it in, say, hey, it's hanging out. I then take it out of the knapsack.
Wait, why don't you take it out? You don't know. You haven't seen the rest of the list yet.
No. But what is clear is I'm not taking out the 4. Recognize what we're doing. There is a test that is implicit in what we're doing. Does the next item still fit in the knapsack? Okay? Well, one way to tell is if I keep a running total of the amount of room that is left. So I put 4 in. Now once I've put it in, 5 minus 4 is 1. I've only got what room. My problem really now is there a room for one more, a unit 1 in what's left? Yes?
So maybe for your question, it's an O1 operation to check, right? So it would increase the complexity of the algorithm if something fits, and then just skip it if it doesn't.
Oh, but I'm saying that that's false because that we already know the last number is 1, but if that had been negative 1,
okay, the usual way to think, the way that I am thinking about this algorithm is you have 2 thieves in the jewelry store. There is one guy with the knapsack, and the other guy is passing him items, okay? And he has a knapsack, he takes this thing from the guy, 4 fits into the backpack. He takes the next item. Hey Joe, this doesn't fit. He tosses it aside and waits for the next one. That is what I'm assuming the first fit algorithm is doing. Okay, is that just because the one item doesn't fit, he's going to keep scanning through the rest of the items, and hopefully something else will fit to take up more room. Yes? You mean what about negative numbers? Oh, okay. So you're claiming that if there was something weirder, if we had negative numbers. So fortunately, we aren't going to have negative numbers, and that solves the problem. I should have probably specified that. That's why, one should have specified that earlier, okay? Let's say I don't want to deal with negative numbers now, okay? Any questions? Although, notice that the same counterexamples will work for that same problem, even if you're allowed negative numbers, because none of these happen to have negative numbers, okay? Any questions? Okay. Any question about counterexamples? Now, there was one thing last class where, we were asked, it came up to try to find a counterexample for our problem of finding the shortest open walk that visited a bunch of points. Does everybody remember that problem? We had our robot, bzz, 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 and it was noticed that if you're soldering robots, the robot's willing to go backwards. There's no reason why you need to actually have a closed tour. And we had this heuristic where we were always going to try to take the closest pair of points at every given possibility until it created and keep doing it, except them until they wouldn't get it fit in a simple path, okay, a simple walk. And we said that, I said that wouldn't, that heuristic would fail, but I didn't have a counterexample. So one student mailed me a counterexample. Where is he? Okay, come up and draw your counterexample. Okay, let's just do this. And
here is an equilateral triangle. And I have 4 spots here. One is this point, which is the height of the triangle. And these 3. So first line, we'll pick this one. Let's put down B, C, and D. So first, I will pick DC. The second one will be BD. And the third one is either AB or AC because they are the same. Let's say AB, okay. So let's add them up. And I find a shorter path, which is AD plus DC plus BC. First, AD plus DC, which is AC. So it's just equal to AC plus BC. So here is that we need to compare BC is even larger or smaller than BD plus DC, right? So according to we know the triangle some rules, BD plus DC is larger than BC.
Okay. So does everybody get that? Let's just see if we get this example, okay? He's telling us that these lengths are the same, right? This length is the same as that length. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a different length, let's say. Okay? He's giving us two possibilities. The heuristic is going to take this very, very short thing, then this thing, and then to make it a simple walk, it's going to do this. Does everybody see that? But he's saying, what is a better solution? A better solution would be to do this plus, wait. You want to say, take DC, and BC, okay? And his claim is that this is going to be, you're claiming that this is going to be a shorter one. Okay, is that really shorter? Is that obviously shorter? Okay, if what's equilateral? If this and this and this are all the same? Okay, wait a second. So you're telling me, let's draw this right. Equilateral to me means three of these are the same size. Is that right? Or do you mean isosceles?
I mean two lines are same.
Okay. So let's just take, I think his is right, but let's go and explain it again. Let's try to explain it the way that I would like to explain it, and let's see whether I believe it or not. Let's say we have a situation where it looks something like this, okay? Where there is this big thing, this thing is almost as big. There's a little extension, and there is a 90-degree thing going on here. Let's take a look at this, okay? He's telling me that what his heuristic is going to do is do this, followed by this, followed by presumably this. Okay, these two, let's say, are almost the same size. He's going to do something like that, right? Now, what is an alternative? An alternative would be to go like this, and like this. Okay? Now, which is going to be shorter? Okay? We're both sharing this edge, right? Start at the top, go left, and then go right. Okay, wait a second. This is a little embarrassing.
The top of the triangle.
Yeah.
Go left, and then go right, all the way.
You think these are the minimum ones?
Equilateral, yes, it would work that way.
Okay, the trouble is it's not equilateral because of how you draw it, okay? So I'm a little confused here. I think you're right, actually, when I went through and did this. But I'm now getting confused. Let me show you how I would have proven this. This is, by the way, probably right, okay? But let me just go through, and since I'm getting a little nervous up here, let me show you how I would have done it. I would be thinking about, what if we have 3 points here, 1 point here, and 3 points here, okay? Where this distance is slightly less than the separating distances of these. Does everybody kind of get this one? This is 1 minus epsilon, 1 minus epsilon, 1. Okay, you see my configuration of 7 points? What is the take the shortest edge thing going to do? It's going to say, aha, take that. Aha, take that. Does everybody agree? See with that, right? Now, it's going to say, well, there's a bunch of ties, although I could probably make you do what I want with it, okay? But Suppose, let's say, I make you do this, okay, and I choose this. What is the next thing you've got to do? You've got to somehow do a double length walk to get back to that point. Does everybody see that? That there's no way, once I have made these two decisions, you're going to get away without a double length walk. And in fact, even two double length walks, right? Is there a better way to do this one? A shorter way to visit all these points? Okay. I believe the shorter way is the sigma. Okay. If we do this, what do we have? Here we've got one length, one length, one length, one length, two square root of two lengths. Does everybody see that? With the other way to do it, you had one length plus two twos instead of two square root of twos. How many people believe that this is a shorter tour than, I guess it was this? Who here believes this is shorter than that? Okay? If so, I believe this is now convincing that the that you made this bad mistake by merging through the center, okay, otherwise. How many people believe this example? How many people are confused by this example? Okay? So hopefully this now should convince you that, in fact, this heuristic is bad on the closing, on the case without a close. Okay? And what was the idea behind this counterexample? Okay, let's think, how did I come up with this counterexample? If I want to find something to break your algorithm, I've got to make you want to do something that that you shouldn't want to do. That's kind of, I guess, what it means, right? And by putting this middle point here and making it slightly closer, I tempted you, fatally, to cut across this thing, okay, when in the middle, when you didn't really want to be in the middle, because you had to get to both sides of it. Okay? Any questions? And so what did I use? Mine has more points than maybe I'm really happy with, but I like the fact that the distances involved are fairly simple, usually just one or two or square root of two. Okay? And I think this is relatively simple to understand. I think yours is right, too, by the way. So we'll file that away. But under duress, this is one that we can use. Any questions? Any questions about counterexamples in general? Now, this when we get to the section on graph algorithms, we are going to be talking a lot about algorithms whose correctness is not obvious. And this is where looking for counterexamples is a healthy thing. Sometimes people in this class get misled because the next unit's going to be on sorting and searching. This is about data structures. This is about efficiency. The correctness of a sorting algorithm is usually not a very subtle thing to show, okay? But recognize for many algorithms that that correctness is subtle, and you got to look for counterexamples. Any questions? Okay, good. Okay, so what I would like to talk about now is I'd like to go through the notions of the big O notation and how we are going to analyze, score the efficiency of algorithms. So one of the great things about algorithms, if you're a professor and teaches algorithms, one of the great things about teaching undergrad algorithms is it doesn't change very much every year, okay? That, I can blow my dust off my slides and not change them too often. And why? But you're saying, my God, computers change all the time. There's all these, all these new things and every year the speed of machines doubles and yada, yada. The reason why I can get away teaching, using a book that's several years old, okay, is because algorithms is a very durable thing in computer science. It's independent of machines. There's a way of analyzing it, the performance of algorithms, that's independent of, the relatively small changes that happen in computers year to year, okay? And this is because we're going to analyze algorithms on the basis of something called the RAM model of computation, okay, which stands for random access machine, okay? And what it is it's a very, very simple model of how computers work or should work, okay? And we're going to assume that this is what computers do, okay? We're going to assume that in our computer, again, a computer is a computer. It has a memory, it has a CPU, it has instructions. We're going to assume that every single instruction, okay, as mapped to a program statement in a programming language, is one simple operation. To do an addition takes one step. Okay, maybe I call it a computron. That's usually what I call it. It takes one computron to add things, one computron to subtract things, one computron to test if two things are equal, one computron to branch to a different place if they're different. Okay? One step for every operation. Okay? We're going to assume, now recognize that loops, though, are not one operation. When you say a loop goes 4i goes from 1 to 10 versus loop 4i goes from 1 to a billion, they take different amounts of time. That's because a loop takes one step for every time you go through the loop. Does everybody see that? So loops, when we count them, we're not just going to add up how many program statements there are. We're adding up how much execution steps are there on the course of the path. And loops then take time proportional to how many times they go around. Likewise, a subroutine call. You can't make a program faster by taking a lot of the code and sticking it in a subroutine and then say, look, call this big thing. You can't say, look, my program now says call this big thing. It takes only constant time. The answer is no, because this big thing is a subroutine and you got to expand it and count all the operations executed there. Any questions about it? The other operation is, the other, let's say, fact that's important about the RAM machine is we're going to assume that every memory access takes exactly one step. Okay? So the way once we have one of these machines, we're going to say the runtime of any algorithm is on a particular data set is basically what we get by counting the number of these steps, okay, the number of computrons used by that. Any questions? Now, is my model of a random access machine a real model of a computer? Is it true that every operation in the instruction set of your computer takes the same amount of time? No, it takes longer to multiply things than it takes to add them, right? Is it true that, I guess the second thing is probably true, okay? I have no doubt that loops take more time the bigger the thing is. So I think that the second one I'm not lying about. Is it true that every memory access in your computer takes the same amount of time? No, you're saying, no, we have these exciting computers with caches and caches of caches and three levels and all this kind of stuff. We are going to ignore what real computers do and not worry about caches. And we're not going to worry about the differences of instruction strength, okay? And the reason is because we want a very simple model that is accurate in covering what computers do. And if we ignore these details, we get a very, very useful model that is general enough to reason about in an intelligent way, which it would be impossible to reason about some ungodly complicated cache system or anything like that, okay? Any questions about that? So I think the RAM model of computation is useful to us in the same way that the flat Earth model is useful. How many people here believe that the Earth is flat? Okay, a small number. How many people believe it is round? Okay. How many people, when they bought their sneakers, carefully checked to make sure the bottom of their sneaker was beveled to reflect the rotation, you know, the curvature of the Earth? The answer is no. Okay, when they manufacture sneakers, they say the world is flat, right? In most of the scale of things that you're working on, the fact that the Earth is flat is basically what you're assuming, right? And the same thing is, I think, true about our model. And the scale of telling what is a very fast algorithm from a very slow algorithm, this model is good enough to do it, okay? And, you know, at the borderlines, you know, oh, should I use it? You know, should I use a hash table or should I use, you know, a linked list or something like that? Here, maybe it gets more fuzzy, okay? But that's not the level we're interested in. Any questions about that? Yes?
So to test the caches in an algorithm, how many
Okay, so you're now asking something about, well, there's a couple of, you're asking about how would I test the efficiency of an algorithm? So some people might say, the way I'm going to tell how efficient my algorithm is, I'm going to program it up, I'm going to run it on some examples and see how fast it is. That is not what we're going to do. What we are going to do is analyze it using the worst case big O notion that I'll talk about in a few minutes. And we're going to get a theoretical asymptotic running time, how fast, many steps it takes as a function of the size of the input. Okay? And the claim is that if we have one algorithm that is asymptotically much worse than the other, the one that's with the lower asymptotic complexity is faster. If we have two algorithms that are the same asymptotic complexity, we're going to say we don't know which is faster. They're both about the same speed as far as we're concerned. So for things that are in the same, let's say, big O complexity, it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do an experiment to say whether one is faster than the other. But we're going to talk about the theoretical analysis in here that's going to argue if things are of different complexity classes, then there's no reason to even do the experiment. When the data gets big enough, the faster algorithm is going to win. Any questions? Okay, good. Okay, so what do I mean by worst case complexity? The way I want you to think about this on an abstract level is the following. You can imagine that, let's say you have a particular algorithm problem, okay? Let's say it happened to be sorting, okay? We could imagine building a graph for any given algorithm and any given algorithm problem. We could build the following kind of a graph. We could take conceptually every possible input to that algorithm. If it's a sorting algorithm problem, what is the input to a sorting algorithm, a sorting problem as we've described before? Last class we described it as a set of numbers. Does everybody agree with that? So you could imagine, and what differs from a set of numbers is not really the number values, but the ordering of those, relative ordering of those number values. So you could imagine that if I gave you three numbers to sort, it could be the numbers, they could be in sorted order, they could be in something in between, they could be in inverse order. 3, 2, 1. Does everybody agree that if I gave you three numbers, there were six possible orderings to it? You could kind of imagine the following graph in space, where I take all the universe of all sorting problems. Every sorting problem has n items. Every sorting problem is defined by a permutation of the items as they come in. There are six permutations on of three items. And lo and behold, what we could imagine if I had an algorithm, by using the description I described before, I could count how many steps that algorithm takes on that input. Does everybody agree? If you have an algorithm that is written down, the RAM model gave rules for how much each step cost. If I executed that algorithm on a particular input, it would take a certain number of steps. Does everybody agree with that? This is now a graph that shows, for every possible sorting instance, what is the size, the number of elements, and what is the number of steps it took, okay, on that particular instance. Here there are six instances, because there are six possible arrangements of three things. In the four column, there's 24 possible points, okay? And the claim is that for any algorithm specified, written down nicely, there is mentally this graph that has to exist, okay, of running time on each example for that algorithm. Any questions? If we have this graph conceptually before us, we will say that the worst case running time of the algorithm is simply the top point, the line, a curve that goes through the top point on every, you know, for every value of n. That is what we mean by the worst case complexity of the algorithm. Any questions? Yes. Why aren't they straight between here? Well, part of it is maybe the guy that was drawing it was a little drunk or something. But I guess a way to think about it is they're probably really, it's not clear what it means to be between these things. What is 2.5? Okay, let's take a look at it. What is 3 factorial? What is 3.5 factorial? Right, it's only defined at integer points. Does that make sense? Right? So likewise, think of this as really being a function that's defined only at integer points, and we're just drawing a curve through it for visualization purposes. Okay? That's, I guess, the way that I would be thinking about it. The bumps here that I drew between these don't really have any meaning. Any questions? Okay? So we're going to say that we're going to talk about the best case would be the line that goes through the fastest possible examples. The worst case is the line that goes through the worst examples. You could also imagine an average case that is what you get by averaging all the points in that column. Okay, and all of these functions describe running time as a function of size. That's what's important to see. The worst case complexity is a function of running time as a function of size of the problem. How many elements are input? The best case is a running time as a function of size, the number of elements that are input. Same thing with the average case. Any questions? Okay. Now, the key thing to note is that all of these complexities are defining a numerical function of time as a function of size. We agree it's an integer function, a function only defined on integers. And you can imagine we can interpolate between the integers in some smooth way that we would like it to be. But it's clear that as a function of size, it's time as a function of size. Any questions? So there are 3 different notions that we have here of measuring what the running time of an algorithm is. Which of these 3 notions, best case, worst case, or average case, is most meaningful? Okay? And maybe as a way to warm it up, let's think what would happen if people made the decision of buying a lottery ticket based on whether they were interested in best case, worst case, or average case. When a person encounters a lottery, what will they do if they think in terms of best case thinking? They'll buy a lottery ticket. They'll say, oh, great. You know, you mean it for $1, I might win $1 billion back? That's great. Okay, and they'll definitely want to buy it, right? What would someone who thinks in worst case thinking think about, yeah? Worst case person says, oh, no, even if I could win with almost every possible ticket, okay, if there's one losing ticket in that pile, I am not going to buy it. Okay, does everybody see that? Okay. Now, what would the average case person do? Okay, they would carefully analyze the probabilities and figure out what is the probability of me winning and is the expected value of me buying this ticket or the probability of there being a winning here. So everybody see that those are different mindsets, right? Lead to different behaviors. Now, which is going to be the way that we're going to want to think in this class? Generally speaking, we are going to think about worst-case complexity in this class, okay? First of all, best-case complexity is stupid. This should be very clear, okay? That, you know, why would I care about the best-case complexity of my algorithm? Maybe if I wanted to give a demo to the teacher. Look, you see how fast my algorithm is? Look, okay? Best case is out, okay? Worst case turns out to be hit a very good sweet spot because it's relatively easy to do a worst-case analysis of an algorithm. And generally speaking, for the most part, in a big picture, usually the worst case is not that much different than what it does on average or usually. Not always. That's not a proof. That's a general claim. And usually, if you try to beat the worst case complexity down. Usually there's a way to do it so that the worst case complexity will be the same as the average complexity. Okay? If you're, you know, that's not a formal claim, but that's just an in practice thing. So usually in here, this class we're going to deal with is worst case complexity. And in particular, when it comes time to homeworks or exams, if I say, give me an algorithm that runs in n log n time, I mean worst case, unless I tell you otherwise. Okay? Now, that said, there do exist certain algorithms now that are becoming more important, things called randomized algorithms, where average case-like analysis is important. Okay? And we're going to talk a little bit in here about randomized algorithms. Okay? But in general, our bread and butter analysis in here is going to be worst case. Any questions about that? Okay? Fair enough. Now, the question here is there is a problem. So we're going to be interested generally in saying something about the worst case number of steps that on a RAM machine that a particular algorithm is going to take over as a function of size. And what I'm going to tell you is that a function like that is a very tricky function to deal with exactly. Okay? So you could kind of imagine that that in a complicated enough algorithm, okay? Well, let's take a look at it. Let's take a look at Bill Gates. Here's, I guess, another way to think about it. If you want to plot Bill Gates' wealth over time, okay, presumably it looks something sort of like this. Okay? This is presumably true. Now, if you think about it, okay, if you try to describe that function exactly, you've got to describe every bump and, when the stock market went down that day, he took a hit. The next day it went up, okay? To describe that function in a simple way it's a complicated function. Does everybody see in all its detail? Now, if I had a function like this, okay, that had the property that it was a simple function that was above Bill Gates' thing, I might be able to describe Bill Gates' wealth is growing, f of Gates, f of at time t, Bill Gates' wealth is going to grow something like x squared, okay, or t squared, okay? If I had shape of my curve is wrong here, but the important point here is recognize that the real-world function is messy and complicated, but it probably has a generally simple shape that sort of describes it. Okay? And the big O notation is a way of describing messy functions by simple shapes, okay, that describe the general trend. What do we know about Bill Gates? The important thing is that over time he's getting richer. That's the important thing, right? Okay? And he's getting richer at probably a fairly steady rate, okay? And that if we concentrate on trying to figure out the exact function, it's too much detail, and you can't say anything simple about it. Any questions? Yes? Okay, so what's it supposed to be? This is supposed to show me this is, let's say, the worst case complexity of a particular algorithm. And what I'd like to do is to describe it, not in terms of the function itself, which is messy, but simple functions that are upper bounds or lower bounds to the complexity, okay? That is why we deal with the big O notation. How many of you have seen the big O notation in previous classes? Okay, how many of you liked it? Okay, some of you didn't like it. Okay, about 50-50, okay? That said, we're going to deal with it anyway, okay? Any questions? So, the important thing is that realize that the big O notation is intended as a tool for simplifying analysis, stripping away detail that we are not going to care about, okay, so that we can reason about these things in a simple way, okay? And what we're going to talk in particular mostly about three functions, big O, big omega, and big theta, Okay? And these are going to describe things in terms of upper bounds and lower bounds. We're going to say that g of n is big O of f of n if some constant times f of n is an upper bound on g of n. That's kind of the definition that we're looking for here. This is a sort of a crude definition. I'll give you a little more precise one in a second. We say that g of n is omega of f of n if some constant times f of n is a lower bound of g of n. Okay? And we're going to say that g of n is theta of f of n, meaning that there is one constant times f of n that makes it an upper bound, and one constant times f of n that makes it a lower bound. That means that kind of f of n really is a nice description of what g of n really is doing. Any questions? Yes. Okay, so we're going to look at, okay, there's a question of how do you work with this and you drop off the highest degree polynomial, that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's true. And next class, we're going to talk about why that's true. I don't think we're going to talk about that true now. But in general, what we are looking for is a simple upper bound that is going to describe what our function is. Okay? So let's take a look at that. Let's say that, what is the reasoning behind what you're saying? I'm going to jump ahead more than I should. Suppose I tell you that here's your function, I guess we're going to call it g of n. And suppose I show you there's some function f of n that is going to be equal to n squared plus n. Okay? And I want to now know is g of n equal to big O of f of n? What does that mean? It means, is there some constant times this such that this, the constant times this is always bigger than this? That's really what it's saying, right? So suppose there is. Suppose there is some constant C such that, in this case, g of n is less than or equal to C times, in this case, n squared plus n. Right? This is what it means to be part of the big O. Okay? Maybe I'm making this more complicated. I'll go back and do it again, but I want you to pay attention here because it's answering his question. Don't ask your question. Let's just figure this for a second. Notice that suppose that we say that we can prove that there's some constant, let's say 7, such that 7 times n squared plus n is always bigger than this. Then we would say that g of n is big O of f of n. Okay? Now you were saying, what about that dropping that powers, that bigger powers thing? If 7 times n squared plus n is always bigger than this, can anybody suggest a constant such that that times n squared alone is always bigger than this? Yeah? Well, let's think about it, okay? Is there some constant that I could use instead of 7, such that that constant times this is always bigger than this? Yeah?
1?
It's not necessarily true. Certainly it's not 1. Because if I'm promising you that 7 times n squared plus n is bigger than this, does it mean that 1 times n squared is always bigger than this? No. Right? If I gave a constant like 14, okay, we have to be a little bit careful about actually proving it, but do you see what might happen here? Do you see that if 7 times n squared plus n is bigger than this, do you see that 14 times just the bigger one of these two is also going to be, this is 14n squared is probably bigger than this, isn't it? So that means that we probably didn't need this in the complexity bound, right? That was what was kind of being hinted at to you about dropping these higher order powers. If that meant something to you, go, how many people did that mean something to? How many people didn't that mean something to? Okay, a few who will admit it, okay? But we'll talk more about that a little bit next class, okay? Let me just go through and do it my way then. Okay, what is the big O? What is the big omega? What is the big theta here? Okay, I think of it in terms of upper bounds and lower bounds, okay? And again, here I might, pictures may very well have inverted things. But we'll say that one thing is an upper bound. We're going to say that we're interested in something being an upper bound if there exists some constant times one of our functions. G of n is going to be an upper bound of f of n. I think I'm reversing my notation here, but don't let that confuse you. G of n is an upper bound of f of n. If there is some constant times G of n, such that once we get for big enough integers, okay, it is always, that constant times g of n is always bigger than f of n. That's what I mean by an upper bound. Does everybody see that? G of n is an upper bound because a constant times g of n always beats up on f of n. Any question? At least once we get big enough for x, big enough x. Okay? Yes. Okay, we'll talk. Wait till I give you the definition. But the answer, how do I choose what big enough is? You just have to point out a point where it's big enough. Okay? It might be big enough when it's 1. It might be big enough when it's 100. So long as you can show me a point where, beyond this, it's always true, that's good enough. It's going to be up to you. Okay? But we'll talk about that in a second. Likewise for our lower bound. G of n is a lower bound of f of n if there is some constant times g of n. That once we have a large enough value of x, that's always less than f of n. Okay? And that's our omega thing. And the theta thing is true if there exists two different constants such that one of them makes g of n an upper bound of f of n, and one of them makes g of n a lower bound of f of n. Then we know that g of n and f of n are the same things. Any questions about that? Yes?
Could big data be interpreted as saying something about the average case?
Big data is not saying something so much about the average case as it's saying it's true from here on out. Okay? So, basically... when you guys turn, at some point you're going to turn, I guess, 18. Is 18 the age when you become a grown-up? If I say this is true, then beyond 18, you know you're grown-ups. Some of you may have been mature at 17. Some of you may have been mature at 16, okay? But we're saying that the law is basically saying that as of 18, then from 18 on out, you are a grown-up, right? And likewise, what we're going to be saying is from this point on out, okay, there is a point from here on out where it's always going to be true. For this value, it's always true. Even if we picked a higher value, okay, from here on out, it's always true. Are people, I'm now 55. Am I going to be a grown-up the rest of my life? Yes, okay, you could say that from here on out, I'm going to be a grown-up, and that's true, okay? And likewise, you can pick your... We're saying that sort of from here on out, something is going to be true, okay? And we're saying that the statement is true if there is some place where from here on out, it's going to be true. Any questions? Yes? Oh, sorry. David, let me go through my thing before we answer this a little bit. Let's go through the formal definitions again. I've kind of done this maybe in a more disjointed way than I like to do it, okay? Let's now get through, What's true about the theta and omega and f of n, these are mathematical definitions. When you ask me if something is true, the way you tell whether it's true or not is you go back to the definition. And that's true in every single one of these big O type homework problems. If I say, is this big O of that? How do you tell? You go back to the definition. What is this thing? Okay, at some point we have to probably figure out a rule to, I may have to cancel office hours. I think that's what I'll do. I think I'm going to, from now on, cancel, no more office hours this semester. I'll take it off my calendar and then we won't have this problem. Okay, good. Okay, where was it here? Boom. Okay, good. Okay, so let's go through and let me just try to explain this one more time. We say that f of n is big O of g of n. If there exist two positive constants, n0 and c, such that for all x greater than n0, the value of f of n is less than or equal to c times g of n. That is what it means to say is f of n big O of g of n. Okay? If you can find two constants, you show me an n0 and a c that do it, then that is true. Okay? If there do not exist values of n and c that do that, it is not true. Does everybody see that? Second thing, we say f of n is omega of g of n. If there exist positive values of n0 and c, such that for all x greater than n0, f of x is always greater than or equal to c times g of n. And we say f of n is theta of g of n. If there exist positive constants n0, c1, and c2, such that for all x greater than n0, f of x is always less than c1 times g of n and greater than c2 times g of n. Okay? If you show me those constants, it's true. If you can't find those constants, it's false. Any questions? I thought I saw one there. I saw one earlier there. That's why. Well, yes.
Okay, so what we're basically saying is a constant only has a theta of g of n if the O and the omega are the same.
It happens to be true that if something is, f of n is theta of g of n, if it is both big O of g of n and big omega of g of n. Okay? This top one says we got an upper bound. The middle one says we got a lower bound. Bottom one says we got a tight bound. Any questions? Yes?
Sorry, I need to rephrase my question. I was wondering if the upper bound and lower bound are related to worst case and best case scenarios.
Okay, the upper bounds related and lower bound for worst case? The answer is no. What's important here is that our function, okay, that we're interested in, f of n, is a function. It could be Bill Gates' wealth as a function of time. It could be the worst-case complexity of an algorithm as a function of size. It could be, how much time do you wait at a bus stop every day? Okay? The claim here is f of n is a messy function you don't know about. Okay, a messy function. G of n is going to be the simpler description of it, what the basic trend in it is. The function we are going to most often be interested in is not Bill Gates' wealth, but is going to be the worst case complexity of a particular algorithm. Okay? And that's what the thing tying is. The worst caseness is not in the upper and lower bound. Okay? The worst case is in the middle function. Okay? That's what we're trying to encode there. Any questions? Okay? Fair enough. Okay, let's look at some examples. Again, there's two different issues here. One is the issue of how do we work with the mechanics of the big O, and there's the other of what it means, and you got to keep these things straight. F of n, the thing here on the right, on the left, is the function that we are caring about. Generally, this is the worst case running time of the algorithm. And we want to describe that in terms of the thing on the right, which is going to be a simpler functional form. Okay? So we can talk about it. Okay? But let's take a look at a particular example. The first question up top says, is 3n squared minus 100n plus 6 big O of n squared? Is it? You say, yes, I don't know. The only way I can tell is I go back to my definition. If it is true, what do we know? We know there have to be constants, okay, that will do it, right? We know that there's going to have to be some constant times n squared, such that this is always greater than or equal to 3n squared minus 100n plus 6, okay? Is there a value of n, of c, that will do the job here? Okay? You see what I'm saying? If the thing on the left is big O, the thing on the right, there's got to be a constant here that I multiply the thing on the right and it's always bigger than it, at least once we get past it. What is a reasonable value of c? 3 is a reasonable value of c. What's another reasonable value of c? 4 is a nice one. Does anyone have any other ones? Yeah?
2 million.
2 million's a perfectly fine one. Does everybody see? So long as I have a constant here, such that it is multiplying it times this is going to make it bigger than this for all n greater than n naught, okay, then I'm done. Once I pick my c, you said 3. Suppose I pick 3 as this thing. Is 3n always bigger than this? This is 1 is 100n. Is that always bigger than it? What? No, not for n equals 1, right? Because that minus 100 is going to do me in, right? Is there a value of n naught such that this is true? Yeah, probably. What would it be? Solve the equality is probably the right way to do it, right? But an even better way than doing it, is there an answer by which it's obviously, obviously true? Can anyone give me an n naught such that this is obviously going to be bigger than this? Okay. Maybe for all n greater than, let's say try 100. Let's see 100. Is it obvious that 3n squared, I guess we need this to be bigger than this, right? Is everybody, that's the equality you're talking about, right? And it's true for n equals 1, I guess, right? So already it's true for 1, but certainly it's true by the time we get to 100. Does everybody agree with that? And if I picked a bigger value up here, I heard 4, I heard 2 million, that means I can probably get away with a smaller value of n naught. Does everybody see that? But I don't get points for that. So long as there exists a c and an n naught that do the job, the relation is true. Does everybody agree? Okay, let's keep moving then. What about the second one? Is it true that the thing on the left is big O, the thing on the right? Is that true? You say, yeah, how can I do it? I have to go back to the definition. Okay? The only way I can do this is there, of course, eventually, once you're good at this, you can do it in your head. Is there any constant C and N naught such that this thing is always going to be bigger than that? What would those C's and N naughts be, yeah? Okay, so you want to say C equals 1. Okay, let's say we could do it with C equals 1. Let's think about it. Okay, could C be equal to 1? Well, it's not going to be true at the very beginning, though, is it? But does everybody see that there exists an n naught such that for all n greater than n naught, this is going to be true? What would be the right way to figure out that n naught? Okay? Probably setting equality. This is what he kind of suggested, right? If I ask, what is the value of n naught such that this is equal to that? Then this side is growing faster than this, isn't it? So once you get equality, once you get beyond that, this thing's going to take off much faster than that. Does everybody agree with that? So if you set this equal to this, solve for n, maybe n's going to be 3 or 4 or something like that, and then convince yourself that this is always going to be greater than that, you're done. Yes?
So is there any, like, now that we see that on isn't like the, is there like a minimal big O notation kind of thing that's more useful? Because you can tell.
Is there anything more useful than big O? There's nothing more useful than big O. Okay, except I guess big theta is more useful than big O. Big theta is a tight description on what that thing is. If I tell you that this complicated mess is really big theta of n squared, I'm saying it's growing n squared. That's right, right? That's because n squared is both an upper and lower bound on this thing. So that's very useful.
Minimal big O or something like that? Because we tell sorting algorithms are O n cubed, and that doesn't help.
Well, okay. Recognize that what the big O notation is doing, recognize that there's two different questions. There is the mathematical notation for the big O, and there is what function are you bounding? If I give you a big O bound on Bill Gates' wealth, that tells me something about Bill Gates' wealth. It tells me nothing about an algorithm, right? If I give you a big O bound on the worst case complexity of the algorithm, it tells me something about the algorithm. Here we are working with the mechanics of the notation of the big O. Recognize that this thing in the algorithm complexity, this is going to be the worst case complexity as a function of n. It's a messy function. We want to find a simple thing to talk about, like theta of n squared, to describe what that behavior is. Okay? Now you're saying, how do I tell when one algorithm is better than another? If I have one algorithm that is theta of n squared and another that is theta of n log n, I know which one is better, right? Because, you know, but that's dominance, which we'll talk about next time. Any questions? Yes?
Yeah, I think he was claiming you wouldn't know which is better because that just says it's an upper bound.
Okay, you're correct in saying that there's an upper bound, okay? So when you ask me if we just talk about upper bounds, if all you know is an upper bound, you can't necessarily compare it. I'm going to give you, I don't do this to anybody, okay, but I'm going to give you an upper bound on how much I am worth as an individual. I am worth less than $100 billion, okay? Now, who's worth more, me or Bill Gates? I'm going to tell you, he's also worth less than $100 billion, okay? The upper bound by itself isn't sharp enough to make that comparison, right? You need both an upper bound and a lower bound. Once you say Bill Gates' lower bound is $1 billion, okay, he beats me, okay? Does everybody see that? So you're right in saying that we like to describe things by the theta notation. That means we really know what the behavior of the function is. And in fact, when we analyze algorithms, we sometimes are sloppy because we say big O when we really mean theta, okay? But you're right, you need the theta to really do that kind of comparison. Any question? Okay, let's keep marching through these because we're running a little late, okay? But hopefully this is going to help. Is 3n squared, this thing, big O of n? Let's take a look at that. If we get rid of, let's get rid of everything here. All I've got is 3n squared minus 100n plus 6. Is this less than or equal to some constant times n? Is there any constant where this is true? Okay. Can anyone give me a constant such that that constant times n is always going to be bigger than this? Oh, come on. What if that constant is a billion? Big constant, right? Isn't this side always 10 billion? Is this side always going to be bigger than this? It'll be bigger for n equals 1, for n equals 2, for n equals 3. But what's going to happen? When is it going to, eventually lose? Where is a place where it's going to lose? Can anybody give me a value of n where it's going to lose? When n equals as big, I think I don't know what number this is. What is it, 10 million? If n was equal to 10 million, this would be 10 million times 10 million times 3. This is 10 million times 10 million, right? And at that point, it's lost, and it's going to keep losing then. Does everybody see it? You can't make this constant big enough to do what you want. So that one is not big O of n. Does everybody see that? Okay, now some people get confused with this equal sign. What does that equal sign mean? And it's a little bit of an abuse of notation. It's not my abuse, it's everybody's abuse in the algorithm world. But think of that equal sign as meaning in the set of functions. Okay, if you read the equal sign as meaning in the set of functions, we're saying is 3n squared in the set of functions that are order n squared? Yes. Is 3n squared in the set of functions that's order n? No. Okay. Any questions? Okay, let's look at some other examples. Let's look at the omega case. Is it true that, okay, 3n squared is omega of n squared? Okay, you say yes, I can't do it without working out constants here. Now we're asking greater than or equal to. Is there some value of c times n squared such that this is greater than or equal to this? Can anybody suggest a value? C equals 1 is going to be a perfectly good one. Can anyone suggest another constant? 2 is another constant, okay? Can anybody play real dirty and suggest a constant? What if I make it negative, or what if I make it 0? Okay? So we're not allowed to play dirty in here, okay? C has got to be restricted to be greater than 0. We're dealing with positive n greater than 0. We're dealing with C's. The C odds has to be greater than 0 for this to be sensible, right? But the claim is that, yes, there exists a constant such that 3n squared is going to be bigger than n squared, right? The difference is going to be 2n squared, right? So, yes, okay? What about the second? Is there any constant such that c times n cubed is less than 3 times n squared? Is there any constant for that? No. To give it a run for its money, what if I tried something very, very small that's bigger than 0? Okay, is this going to work? No. The answer is no, because by the time we get to, you know, again, you can work out where equality is going to happen. But by the time you get to something like n equals the denominator times the denominator times 3 is going to be bigger, is going to be less than, there's no, at that point, this the 3 times the denominator times the denominator is less than the denominator times the denominator times the denominator, right? So there is no constant here that will do the job. Does everybody see that? And likewise, look at the bottom one. Is there some constant on that we multiply n by such that c times n is going to be, that c times n is going to be less than 3n squared? What constant would work here? What constant would work here to make this side smaller than that? 7 is a good constant. Can anybody give me any other one? Just about any constant you pick here, there will be an n naught such that beyond this, this side is going to be bigger than that, right? And that's what we need to prove the omega. Yes? 1. If you pick c equals 1, this is going to be fine. Now you've just got to find what is the n naught such that this is true. Okay, and I think by the time we get to 100 or so, look for any equality, and beyond that, you could probably argue it's always going to be the case. Any questions? Okay. And finally, when we work out the big theta, theta is true when both O and omega are there. So the left thing is theta of n squared, because O and omega are true. For the middle one, only the O is true, and on the other one, only the omega is true. Any questions about this? We've still got, by my mind, about a minute. Okay, any questions? Yes? There was an N missing on the bottom. On the 100 N, where... Okay, fine, there's an N there, you just can't see it. It's an N. See it? Any questions? Send me mail about that so I fix the slide. Any questions? Okay. Question, yes. Okay, if it's a complicated question, I got to let people go, okay? Next class, do the daily problems, look at these, and we'll talk about it.